Welcome to Trillions. I'm Joel Weber.
And I'm Eric Balchunas.
Eric, today we're going to talk about something called direct indexing. What is that?
Direct indexing is sort of it's a newer, fresher name for what was previously called a separately managed account. And institutions use this a lot and when I wrote my book on the ETF world and how institutions use them.
Shameless plug.
It's called the Institutional ETF Toolbox. It is available on Amazon, but let's move on. I was like, why don't big pensions just buy the ETF? Well, they can go and get the S&P done for even cheaper than the ETF. So separately managed accounts came up in my research. This term is you just buy all the stocks directly and you let a BlackRock just do it. It's almost like your own private ETF and you don't have to go to the public pool down the street. And institutions like that, it's cheaper. And ultimately, the problem with that is in order to get that pricing, you would need $100 million. So it was really an institutional thing. The more money you have, the lower you get charged. That's just generally how investing works. And direct indexing has now come along with technology and sort of said, hey, let's democratize this and bring it to advisors. And there's a couple advantages they think are going to appeal to advisors. There's some competition with mutual funds and ETFs, which I think were the heart of our discussion. Some have I actually have heard the term ETF killer for direct indexing, because obviously if you use this, you wouldn't use an ETF, or you might use them together. So I thought, you know, we should explore this. We recently wrote a note about it where we went through some of the advantages, like a tail of the tape between ETFs and direct indexing. But ETFs aren't all who this competes with, but there's tax benefits and customization benefits, which we'll go over. But direct indexing is kind of, if ETFs are the new kid on the block, this is sort of the new kid on the block in terms of investment products.
So to help us understand them, we're joined by Morgan Barna of Bloomberg Intelligence and also Brian Langstrat, who's the CEO of Parametric. What's Parametric?
The largest direct indexing platform company at $300 billion. So if Parametric were an ETF issuer, I think you'd rank fourth. Just to sort of say, this is how big this is getting. So $300 billion is a ton of money. That said, I think, A, that's way bigger than most others, and B, direct indexing and SMAs are obviously very linked. And like SMAs are big, like BlackRock has over $1 trillion in SMAs. So it's kind of a gray area on where direct indexing begins and SMA ends. But let's just say that Parametric is the biggest of this new wave.
This time on Trillions, exploring direct indexing. Brian, Morgan, welcome to Trillions. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So Brian, I want to start with you. Where did this space come from?
Yeah, so Parametric started what is called direct indexing, or building a separately managed account to target an index and then customize it, in 1992. So it's been around for our shop for 27 years. We think we were one of the first, if not the first. But when we started it, there wasn't a lot of conversation about it.
And how did it come to be?
Yeah. We had a family office client who had struggled with that kind of age-old dilemma of hiring and firing active managers, comparing them to a passive universe, one growth, one value. And together with their consultant came up with the idea, instead of hiring and firing and evaluating these active managers, equity managers, let's buy the universe we compare themselves to. And the really innovation they had
was... You've got to have some money to be able to say, I'm going to buy the universe, right?
Yeah, well, I think you can build and manage a separately managed account that tracks an index for... I mean, it's not a mass affluent product. It's not a product for the masses, but... You know, with a portfolio size of $250,000, $500,000, $1 million, with really consistent tracking here. So you have the same pre-tax experience as that universe, an index, a custom index, the S&P 500, the Russell 3. The idea that they had was, instead of just tracking the universe, and it was their idea, not ours, let's do it, but let's be cognizant of the tax impact. Let's not just rebalance. Let's not trade the securities if it comes out of the index or in it. Let's think about where the gains are, where the losses are in the portfolio. That kind of customization requires you to do it on a separate account basis, portfolio by portfolio. Let's have two objectives: track that universe and really minimize the tax impact of the portfolio. They brought the idea to us. We said that was interesting. We were a small firm, didn't have a lot to do, and we soon found that a lot of other people were interested in the idea. Could you capture the benefit of indexing, the broad diversification, the consistent performance, the low costs, but could you add additional value through customization? And there really are three types of customization that drive this now. Tax is still the biggest, ESG and RI, responsible investing, and then creating your own bespoke exposure, something that's not available in a typical pooled commingled vehicle. And you know, for the last 27 years, it's a little bit bemusing to me to think about this as the new kid on the block. I was the portfolio manager 27 years ago on the account, and hundreds of billions of dollars later, it's become quite an interesting alternative for some. I wouldn't call an ETF killer for some versus ETFs and index mutual funds.
It's interesting, though. Labeling matters. Like, I compare direct indexing is to ETFs and mutual funds as smart beta is to quantitative. Quantitative's been around for a long time, right? You know, decades. But that smart beta label made it seem new and fresh and democratized it. So I think that is why it tends to be looked at as the new thing.
Yeah. And tax regimes come and go. You know, tax rates increase, they decrease. People's sensitivity to taxes. Technology has made it more easily done, more easily understandable. But we've been hammering away at this for 2.5 decades.
What's changed in that time in terms of what the vehicle actually looks like?
Yeah, not a lot. We like to say at Parametric, we only have one or two or three good ideas in 30 years. And this idea...
That's pretty good.
Yeah, well, there's people I think that think have good ideas every day about what to invest in. We don't. The idea, it's a very, very simple idea, and that is capture what we all know inherently to be the value and power and the compelling logic of index-based investing, but do it in a separate account. And once you cross that line from commingled to separate account, the world opens up to you in terms of customization. You can fund with a pre-existing securities. You don't have to fund with cash. So you don't have to realize the gains on the way in if they're there. That's huge for many people. You can do loss harvesting. Loss harvesting is probably the most commonly mentioned benefit, but it is not the end all. It is a lot other. You can do a lot of other tax management, gifting of securities. And then you can build the exposure that might be a little bit different than the index. You can put a responsible screen on it. You can say, I like to tilt toward value. So the technology to build and understand how you manage those exposures continues to evolve. We continue to innovate around the edges, but that central core idea is the same as it was in 92.
You just had a strategic kind of alignment with Eaton Vance. What does this do for the Parametric? I mean, you've been part of Eaton Vance for a long time now, but this new alignment with the fixed income business and the technology, what are you looking forward to?
I want to piggyback off that, which is that I've always heard direct indexing is an equity thing, right? Is it mostly for the equities, but can you do fixed income also? I guess, can you talk about what part of your portfolio can you direct indexing right now?
Yeah, so if we think about direct indexing as buying and holding a broadly diversified exposure, a fixed income exposure, an equity exposure, or maybe both in the same account. They're the most popular fixed income type solution in that vein are laddered portfolios, laddered municipal bond portfolios, laddered corporate bond portfolios. It's a business that has been built up within Eaton Vance since 2008. I think it may have started a few years later. But recently, we combined those products and that investment technique and those investment skills and the technology with Parametric. We kind of redrew the boundaries within Eaton Vance. And now we're coming to market with both. And we always did before, but we're doing it in a coordinated way. We're investing in the systems and the technology. We're investing in the digital tools around it. We're investing in the performance reporting. And that's really what it means to us to kind of reshape the Eaton Vance business, aiming at this very exciting growth market. There's not a lot of growth opportunities in the investment management business, as you guys know. The investment management business is shifting toward rules-based, systematic, low-cost, clear value-added products away from the traditional value proposition of alpha or active management. And we've got a great franchise across that.
So let's bring this up. We'll tackle this in a couple blocks. First is customization. Yep. That's a big benefit here.
It's the only benefit.
Well, the tax thing.
That's customization.
We'll break customization into two parts.
Okay.
Picking the stocks and the tax. When I hear this proposed, it sounds so good. Hey, you don't like this company does this, pull it out. It's like an ESG kind of customization. Or if you work at Apple and you have a lot of their stock, you can pluck that out. Here's the thing, though. We all know that that makes the client the active manager now. And we all know, like, you take the iShares Social Index, it's underperforming the S&P by 31% over 10 years. Are people going to be able to stomach that if they don't completely tie or beat the S&P, because that is a for whatever reason the S&P is like God, or you know, in the, in this in portfolios, and if you customize, your odds of beating it are pretty low. You become an active manager, and we know it's hard. So how does that work?
Yeah, so you've hit the central trade-off of direct indexing, and that is you accept a certain amount of deviation, what we call quant manager tracking error, versus the index in order to avail yourself of the customization. You do it every time you harvest a loss. You do it every time you put in an ESG and RI, every time you tilt. And so the investor has to believe, we can show that over time, those small differences from those customization decisions, those variances versus a pure tracking index, are worth it to them. They average out to be very low on a pre-tax basis, and the after-tax or the ESG or RI benefit comes through very dramatically. And we can show that now over 25 years. So when you deviate from an index, you there's a lot of different ways to do it. If I'm tilting toward a factor or a sector or an industry, well, then I'm probably going to see myself with long periods of outperformance or underperformance. But if my entire deviation from the index can be understood as very small misweightings on an individual stock base, what a risk model would call idiosyncratic risk, they average out over time to look like the index. So if you look at a parametric composite over 20 years, the pre-tax performance, almost indistinguishable from the pre-tax performance of the index. It's the after-tax. But we're trading. That's our currency. Tracking error or mistracking versus customization benefit. And our engineers at Parametric are working on that from 1,000 different angles. But you're right. You have to be willing to accept a difference in order to avail yourself of the customization.
Now, obviously, with an ETF, let's just say the S&P 500, you can now get that for 4-3 basis points, probably 2-1 in the next couple of years. In fact, you can get a whole portfolio for under 10 bips at this point, 10 basis points. How much does this cost, and how hard is it to dislodge such a compelling value proposition, which is this sort of like ETF portfolio, especially from the advisor's mindset, because that's good for them, lower their fund fees, more their fee is intact.
Yeah, no, we love to think about the trade-off there. So let's just make it a – let's say it costs you 30 basis points for a direct index portfolio, and you can get the ETF for free. All right, let's just start with it. 30 basis points is our bogey. We got to add 30 basis points in value over time. Otherwise, you need to go do something else. And the majority of ETF investors should stick with ETFs. But if you find yourself in a position where you have pay high taxes, you fund with pre-existing securities, you got a long time horizon, you're charitably inclined, we can add 150, 200 basis points a year in after-tax performance value above the return of an index. So that's in my mind, one of the best trade-offs in money management. You take 50 basis points of tracking error, you get 150 basis points of excess return, you pay 30 basis points for it. Any quantitative manager out there would think that puts us in the top quartile, top decile. That's the trade-off. But it isn't just the after-tax performance business. If we've been able to build around a pre-existing holding or a series of holdings and defer the gain in that for a long term, if they're charitably inclined, so every year they want to give 5% of that portfolio or 2% to charity, and we can go into the separate account and we can select the most advantageous tax lots, the tax lots that have the largest embedded unrealized gain, and gift those, then the value starts to add up. So the trade-off of our fees and the fees inherent in the portfolio and the costs versus the benefit, we think, is very compelling. Not to everyone. Investors of size, investors with we're tax sensitive, investors who have long time horizons, on and on and on. I think the majority of the money in ETFs, particularly the taxable money, should be in a direct indexing, but maybe not the majority of the investors in ETFs should be in direct indexing.
So when clients and investors come to you, how much of what you're offering is literally an out-of-the-box solution, off-the-shelf solution, versus something that's totally customized for them? And like, are you looking at like, hey, I've got some mutual funds that have just been kicking around forever. Can you absorb those and do something with them?
Yeah. So there you've just hit on the difficulty in running the business. So commingled vehicles, ETFs and mutual funds are great for money managers. You can just the leverage, the economies of scale, the marginal costs, wonderful. Custom separate accounts are a lot of work. We have to customize on the way in. We have to customize during the management, then we have to defend that customization in client service and performance reporting. So it is, we do all of the things you talked about. The simplest example is you come to me with cash and you want a plain vanilla index or a standard index like the Russell 1, and you want simple loss harvesting. That's a pretty plain vanilla portfolio. We probably don't have to work hard to set that up and understand it.
How much cash am I bringing?
You know, we are, our minimums are $250,000 in many programs and platforms. So, you know, we run about 40,000 individually separately managed accounts. They range from a $1 billion account for some of the wealthiest investors in the country down to a portfolio that would be in the high net worth.
Creaking in with 250. Yeah.
And what percent are you dealing with the advisor versus a direct investor?
Almost every portfolio that we manage comes with an advisor. Okay. And I think you hit on the point. One thing that direct indexing does above and beyond this after-tax performance value and customization value relative to its fees is it becomes a tool for the advisor to do value-added wealth management. So it's good for the client, but it's great for the advisor's conversation. They can create a portfolio that has real value that you can't just walk across the street and get another one that looks like it. You can't. You don't see an advertisement for it on the Super Bowl television where you think, here's a branded ETF. This is a bespoke portfolio created in concert with the advisor that solves a problem for the investor.
Yeah, I will say, I just went to WealthStack, which is that conference, fintech-ish. Mm-hmm. This is a big deal, and Morgan and I talk about this a lot when we look at the tail of the tape, is the technology and the value add. Advisors are on the hunt for value add, let's face it. Because they Betterment, Vanguard, everybody's doing cheap advice now. Morgan, why don't you riff on this? Because I think you have the most knowledge about this sort of technological revolution going on in the advisor world.
Yeah, I'm so interested in the way that it seems like Parametric and Eaton Vance are now so focused on the ability to scale accounts at a lower access point, but in part create efficiency so you can continue to really invest. This seems like such a period for investing in technology that enables advisors. How does that play into the distribution?
Yeah. The dilemma that I think in understanding this marketplace is how much of the marketplace for this type of investing is a do-it-yourself? Because there are tools that the investor can just log on and build these portfolios, or a robo when they can hire someone. Or are these tools that an advisor can use themselves in their practice to do it themselves? My belief, after watching this for about 25 years, is that the market for the do-it-yourself investor or the do-it-yourself advisor is relatively small. And that's talking my own book. We've seen the growth. We continue to see it. Maybe that will change. But the tools are improving, but the advice, the consultative, the defense, the ultimate fiduciary responsibility for the performance and any errors or that occur to it need to land on a money manager. So most of the fintech firms, we had our head trader leave Parametric 20-some years ago and start a firm to bring direct indexing technology directly and put it on the desk of the advisor. They eventually pivoted away. There are a lot of firms out there, but our size and the size of our largest competitors in this space are people who actually manage the money. So our job and our goal and our vision is to continue to build technology that enables the advisor to use our services to the best advantage for themselves and the clients.
And how about some of the turnkey asset management mm-hmm. players that are mm-hmm. sort of developing these? Mm-hmm. They already have huge advisor networks, and this becomes defense for them from, you know, clients, you know, considering either being bequested accounts or, you know, considering self-managing. How does that play?
Yeah, we view them as clients for us. We work mm-hmm. within many of the largest turnkey asset management providers. We work within every wealth management platform, advice platform. Mm-hmm. They can choose to build the technology themselves, hire someone else, buy a fintech, or they can work with a firm like ours. The market continues to expand. There will be room for all of those business models. You know, we'll see.
And when I posted about this on Twitter, two advisors wrote back and just said, if I use direct indexing, does the client statement show 500 stocks?
Yeah.
And I remember looking, every time there's an election for president, I look at the financial disclosures of each candidate to find out like how they invest.
When you get them.
Yeah, and you look at like when you get them. And it's always like 7 to 30 mutual funds, maybe some ETFs. But Donald Trump was like 35 pages of stocks. And I imagine something overwhelming coming to a client or an advisor having that fear of handing them just pages and pages of equities and them not really understanding what they do. Because when you look at a couple funds, you kind of understand where you are.
Yeah, that part feels like really old school, actually.
Like a step back. That's what somebody said.
When we started in the broker-dealer platforms and take our family office services and move them into the advice platform. Some of the initial advisors used to call it management by phone book because of the statements that would show up on their client's doorstep were so thick. But the industry, the value is here, so the industry evolved.
It's one way to keep your job, actually.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. The suppression of movement to our electronic conference, electronic statements, and the way that the savvy platforms and advisors compress the parametric line or our competitor's line into a single line, we've solved that for a large part. We don't own all 500 stocks in the S&P 500. It's a distinction without a difference. We own maybe 325 or 250, and we let people cap it. There are competitors of ours who build direct indexing with 75 or 125 names. You know, more than 7 or 8 mutual funds, but maybe I wasn't quite fair earlier. There's two trade-offs between stepping away from an ETF and moving to a direct indexing. First is that tracking or that mistracking difference that I think pays you very well. The second is complexity. And technology is helping us deliver this service cheaper with less of that complexity burden. But look, if you can add the kind of value that's shown here relative to the other opportunities that advisors and clients have to improve their performance, I think people increasingly get over those two things.
One other thing, though, is that the ETF comes with this wrapper,
yep,
right? And that wrapper is backed by the SEC, and it's all sanctioned and everything.
Yep.
This is a step outside that world.
Right.
How do you address that when a client...
Yeah, I haven't seen that so much. I think that's already been done on the advisor side. They've already educated their client on the value of a separately managed account. I think that's a headline, a pretty interesting idea. But if you really lift up the hood and say, look, what I'm owning here is 300 of the S&P 500 names, the most highly evaluated and followed companies in the world. I'm owning them in a fully transparent separate account. If something happens to Parametric or happens, they blow up, I still own those stocks tomorrow in my brokerage account. There's no black box inherent secret mixture. There's no leverage. There's very little trading. So I think people think, okay, I don't have an SEC 40 Act registration fund, but I get over that pretty quickly.
Let's talk about the taxes. So obviously this tax advantage, you said 150 to 200 basis points. I was talking to somebody who said, yeah, that's good for a while, but it does run out, especially if the market keeps going up. Obviously with the market going up, finding losses is hard.
Yep.
And I think that's why in 2018 we saw a huge dramatic move of flows because people realized some gains in mutual funds. We saw ETFs take in way more money than they should have.
Yeah.
So the two questions are, one, if the market keeps going up, do you run out of losses and that tax benefit diminishes? And then two, if the market goes down, obviously then you could use ETFs as well. So can you talk about the headwinds of the tax?
Yeah, so let's take those in both of those dimensions. So you're absolutely right. Over time, given an upward trending market and a loss harvesting portfolio, the portfolio becomes what we call locked up. Every position in the portfolio is at an unrealized gain. If it wasn't, you would have traded it, brought the cost basis down. And so the after-tax value of loss harvesting diminishes over time. How fast? Depends. Where the markets are headed, what initial cost basis you started with, what we call the internal volatility of the market is. But to me, that is a criticism, but also a wonderful outcome. If you can buy a broad-based equity portfolio, loss harvest it for 10 years, track the market, have this tax benefit, and end up with a broadly diversified equity portfolio whose cost basis is significantly lower than its market value, you've won. All right. So that's not a reason not to do it 10 years ago. But you may want to shift your focus at the end of 10 years to, you may have additional cash flows. You may be gifting. You may want to terminate the manager or lower the fee because you're no longer getting that tax advantage when the portfolios lock up. But that's an observation. But to me, it's not a very powerful criticism. I'm saying that's the best possible outcome. We could track the market for 15 years, end up with a locked up portfolio, have ourselves the full granular customization ability to do gifting and estate planning, whatever it may be, and continue to track the market. So it is what it is. It's a great outcome, a little bit of a red herring in terms of a criticism.
Let's say the market goes down. Does that tax advantage pitch diminish because now advisors are like, well, yeah, I'm sitting on a bunch of losses in funds?
Yeah, as you might suspect, we've thought deeply about that. Or it's pretty if you own a fund and you want to loss harvest it, you got to get all the way out of that fund. Okay, you have to be out of the market for 30 days, or you buy an equivalent ETF and you have to worry about wash sales. If you harvest losses in a diversified separate account with the granular individual stocks, you can maintain your full market exposure and harvest the losses. You can harvest, you have that degrees of freedom. You have that, so you can harvest more losses because the average market may have gone down, the stock ETF may have gone down 8%, but there's segments of the market, individual securities that are down 15, 20, and you can harvest that out, maintain your market exposure, continue to look at that as as an opportunity. You cannot do any worse in an individually managed separate account and loss harvesting than you can in an ETF portfolio, and you can certainly do better.
One thing, you know, we're watching and considering is this huge wealth transfer coming from, you know, a prior generation. So one of the huge benefits,
I think, is like considered to be the largest transfer of wealth
over
in
history. Trillion.
Yeah.
So I think over $3 trillion. So,
which by the way is this is millennials inheriting from boomers who they're constantly like yelling at.
Yeah.
How nice. Talk about biting the hand that feeds you.
We'll see if you get that money.
Sorry, just a side note that I can't help.
But one of the huge benefits is being able to fund one of these accounts with in-kind securities.
Absolutely.
Right? So how many of the new clients that you see are younger investors that are gifted individual securities and are way more prone to manage those in a passive way as opposed to how they were formerly managed?
Yeah. So there's nuances in there. But to start with the headline, 50% of the portfolios we open, 50, fund with individual securities in-kind. So we're almost a lead pipe cinch no-brainer for funding in kind, because if you fund an ETF, you're going to sell everything, realize the gains, and walk in the door. And you maybe create a tax drag you'll never overcome with the fee difference. So 50%. There's a lot of things that go into thinking about that. Our current tax law allows stocks with unrealized gains to be stepped up and have their basis marked up to the market value if it goes through an estate planning process. So a lot of inheritors, heirs don't come with large unrealized gains because they've had their cost basis stepped up. But so many of the actual portfolios that we look at are coming from a historical individual security management, either themselves or their advisor or an SMA program that may have 25 or 30 stocks. And we very, very commercially point at that benefit and say, if you were to liquidate this portfolio and fund an ETF, it costs you $78,000 in realized tax in taxes. And if you give it to a parametric portfolio and allow us to work it around, it'll cost you $23,000. I'm giving a hypothetical example. And this process is now kept in your portfolio. It's a deferral. $50,000-some in that rough example that can work for you for as long as you need that index exposure, you need that exposure. That drives a great deal of the interest.
Yeah, and we talked about 30, 35 basis points for these strategies. That's obviously a little bit dilutive to your parent company's sort of usual margins. And now you're looking at really scaling. How does the conversation go for how sticky these assets are, that the total margin dollars might be better over time? What are the conversations like?
Yeah, so you have to distinguish between the revenue realization, so the fee rate is lower. I would argue that the operating margins are not. So we may earn 30 basis points for a portfolio or 25 or less for a very large one versus a traditional active strategy in which may earn the company 50 or 60 basis points. But if we can get to scale and we can provide that and we can have a long-term portfolio. These are long-term portfolios. If you have a short time horizon, loss harvesting makes no sense at all because you're just going to harvest the loss and then realize the subsequent gain when you trade the portfolio. We can build a pretty compelling net present value business. So I think, Eaton Vance recognized that in 2003 when they made the investment in Parametric. In 2019, they recognized that. We recognized that, you know, to a much, much larger degree.
And this year, especially, how has the distribution conversation changed? How does this more strategic combination change sort of advisors' access to what you've been providing for so many years?
Yeah, I think we're turning up the volume a bit. We're trying to bring connected, coordinated products to the market, which have fixed income and equities in the same portfolio or in the same conversation. We can, you can do loss harvesting, and we do in our laddered municipal bond and corporate portfolios. You can tax aware rebalance a portfolio across asset classes. We can provide consolidated reporting. We can bring the other wealth management solutions like the exchange fund that Eaton Vance delivers to the market. So we're trying to put all of these like capabilities, which we think are industry leading as individual products, but certainly industry leading as a combination. And we're trying to just make sure that they're as understood as possible in the market.
Okay, let's talk about tracking. It's a boring topic, but it's important.
I like it.
Tracking difference is ultimately the cost you pay.
Yes.
Because it's net all the fees, right?
Yes.
ETFs, like the Vanguard and BlackRock, they are insanely good at tracking.
Yeah.
They've got desks. They can do security lendings. They know how to outsmart the hedge funds for the most part. So if you look at something like VOO, it may charge 3, but its tracking is like 1 basis point. Tracking requires rebalances, dividends, corporate actions.
Mm-hmm.
How confident could I be if I was an advisor to say, you know, how much slippage am I going to get with you because you're not one of these gigantic, experienced firms that is tracking with much more money and has a lot more, brand name behind it?
Yeah. So think about tracking as being two things. First of all, the costs that you say are always negative. You know, so their tracking only goes one direction. Your cost is going to subtract from your return. The other tracking are from your misweighting. The purposeful misweighting of the securities has, in our view, a mean of zero. It can be positive. It can be negative. And given a long enough time, it's going to average itself out if you're doing this consciously. And so we create – it's typical to have a tracking error. Let's just use that term, which is – think about it as a kind of a common bound rail of about 50 basis points. So we're not even in the same game as the VOO. We're not even in the same game.
Let me pause there. I just want to say, let's assume I just wanted the S&P, because I know I'm going to pick these stocks or eliminate a couple that are going to – that's my tracking.
Yeah.
But for the rest, I want to make sure that I'm getting every last bit of juice from the S&P index, and I don't want any slippage for the rest. So let's just say I just wanted S&P from you.
Yeah.
Could you deliver tracking that is in line with a Vanguard or BlackRock?
You wouldn't want to hire us. You shouldn't hire us. Yeah. So a family office early days looked at me when I explained tracking error, and he says, look, you're whipping the wrong horse. He says, I'm going to be invested in this 20 years, and whether or not I get the S&P plus 10 or minus 10 or plus 30 or minus 30, that doesn't matter to me. I'm trying to create and build my wealth. I'm trying to protect it. And if I can get 50, 60 basis points of tax value and that tracking error, that's the right horse. Whether or not I'm up 5 basis points more or 5 basis points less than an ultimate arbitrary market measure, that's the wrong horse.
But you do all those things, right? You take care of the corporate action.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Every detail. Reinvest the dividends.
And do you do emerging markets and international?
We do.
Are a little less liquid, right?
Yeah, we do a lot. Increasingly, the portfolios that we invest in are global. Advisors want to create a global beta portfolio, tracking a global, all-world index.
Why do you think that's happening?
Well, I think, you want to give yourself as many degrees of freedom as you can. So instead of just investing in the S&P market, you can invest in the EAFE markets plus S&P.
More losses.
Yeah.
International's not having a good run lately.
Yeah, well, cross-sectional volatility. I'll get nerdy on you. So cross-sectional volatility, when Japan's up, UK may be down. When securities in the tech sector in the United States are up, maybe the German banks are down. So you can, again, have a more successful outcome of tracking this diverse index and harvesting losses across it. So you've expanded your tool set in your granular separate account. And so that makes a lot of sense.
And basically since 2017, you've been running like a $10 billion a year net inflow for that custom core. Do you see that accelerating with, lower account minimums?
Yeah, I don't necessarily think lower account minimums are going to drive maybe as much as some. And I'm not a big believer in the ETF killer and kind of driving this down. I think you need to be an investor with a certain type of portfolio and a certain tax sensitivity and a certain relationship with the advisor. So many people may differ from me on that. I think this is ultimately a advisor-driven high net worth market product. But there's a lot of opportunity for us to continue to grow and faster. I think of it as this, you guys know this better than me, and you can quote the statistics, but every year there's a flow of money toward index-based, most of them in ETFs and open-end mutual funds, into index-based strategies, both equity and fixed income, hundreds of billions of dollars. Parametric and our competitors, we divert off of that stream a small percentage of that into custom separate accounts. And the people who choose it are choosing it rationally because the value to them is much greater than the tracking error and the fees. We can, through education and continued innovation, continue to divert off more and more of that every year. And Parametric, we want our share. We want to continue to grow market share and be the market leader, but there are others will get it as well. How big can it get? It can get a lot bigger than it is, and it should, in my view, but I would have told you that in 1993, and then, we're at $300 billion, but that's a 30-year road.
Yeah, that's interesting. 1993, is
that? Two, we started.
92.
Yeah,
SPY launched in 93. So you guys are actually just as old, 26 years-ish or whatever.
Yeah.
Early 90s.
Yeah.
You're not based in New York. You're based in Seattle.
That's right.
So talk to us about what
Yeah,
that
you were in Seattle in the
like.
Early 90s, which is like, that's like being in the nucleus of one of the greatest musical rock renaissances known to man, known as grunge.
Can you tell Eric's jealous?
Yeah, yes. Tell me some stories.
Oh, well, I graduated from college at the University of Washington in 1990, and all of the bands that you're talking about, Nirvana, you know, Pearl Jam, all of those were just starting to show up in the clubs. And so, you know, as a young person, we would find ourselves at shows that, in hindsight, we would think that was incredible. And we could tell these great stories. At the moment, we may have not have predicted it was that incredible.
You were around when Eddie Vedder used to climb on top of the roof, the ceiling, and, like, drop down into the crowd, right?
Yeah, seeing Alice in Chains.
Then he got wealthy, and he's like, yeah, I'm not going to do that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, now he plays Safeco Field in three nights.
Yeah, you can't do that
And
there.
Brings out, last time I was there, he brought out his children's teacher onto the stage. It's a different world. Yeah, the Crocodile Cafe. I don't know if you guys come there. You know, one of the, you know, seeing some of the initial bands there. I'm going there in 1991, 1992. It was great fun. Again, you don't know that. You're a 22-year-old kid. You're trying to find a job. You're going to music. And, you know, I mean, when we showed up, I think Seattle showed up on the cover of Time magazine, and we became this hot place, and everybody was wearing their plaid. And we kind of sensed this was kind of cool. But, you know, the Seattle music scene continues to be interesting.
Do you take some of that into your job? Some of that, like, grunge rebellion spirit?
Yeah, I don't know. We do take Seattle into our job.
You still listen to?
I do.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was there. I saw Pearl Jam when they played Safeco last year. Now I'm, you know, 50-something with my wife and trying to leave early.
Cheering
enough.
For Eddie Vedder's teacher.
Yeah, cheering for Eddie Vedder's teacher.
And you said earlier your neighbor opened for Pearl Jam's first show.
Yeah, so my neighbor, who's now a vice president at Microsoft, was the lead singer in a band that opened for Mike. But again, even looking at him across the fence now, you think, what happened to you? You know, at one point you were at the epicenter, but it's great fun. But the audacity of Seattle, Amazon, Starbucks, Microsoft, the business building, it does wash over you. You do have a sense that you can do something maybe on a national scale or global scale where you wouldn't from somewhere else.
Joel's from Portland.
Yeah. Well, there's
a little rivalry. He's a Husky. I'm a Duck.
Oh, no. Yeah. You didn't tell me that at the beginning. This thing's all off.
Yeah, totally.
Who's from Portland? Oh, he just rattled off, like, so many cool people.
Well, you know, Nike, Adidas,
oh,
Intel.
Okay.
Like, we'll throw back. It's all good. It's just a friendly rivalry. You know, the Ducks won this year, though, the football game. Yeah. So that was
Portlandia.
That was
a great show.
Win.
Yeah.
You know, I wanted to actually ask you, like, one final question, which was, you know, this started with a conversation with the family office way back when.
Yeah.
Are you guys still working with that family
office?
We
are. They're still a client today. I mean, that's a layup question. Thank you for asking. But yes, 27 years later, that group still works with it.
That's impressive. Brian, Morgan, thank you so much for joining us on Trillions.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to Trillions. Until next time, you can find us on the Bloomberg Terminal, Bloomberg.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever else you like to listen. We'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter. I'm at Joel Weber Show. He's at Eric Balchunas. You can find Morgan at mbarna6 and Parametric at Parametric LLC. Trillions is produced by Magnus Hendrickson. Francesca Levy is the head of Bloomberg Podcasts. Bye.